Miss Jackson, am I overreacting or is it valid? I wanna have a one-on-one convo about it, man. You sacrifice your life for so the world could see his talent. He's a legend now, I guess it worked out, but I need some answers. Are you happy with the way he been holding your family name? I need to know, cause I can't sleep at night thinking you died in vain. I think it got
right, welcome everybody. What you just heard was a little from Dumani, Miss Jackson. It's a melodic Meet the Grams diss track to a 50 Cent. Where we at?
Okay.
Where we at with Meet the Grams, Max? Were you a fan of the 2024 battle? Did you get a chance to hear that track?
Yeah, I mean, it was hard not to get involved. I feel like everybody got involved in that, right?
We got a special guest. I'm sorry, guys. Max,
you just bring it. It's fine. I'm here. Hello.
We'll get to his introductions here in a bit, but I am curious about that. So you were aware?
Yeah. No, I was a big fan of GNX and like the most recent album drop and all that. So and the beef.
Meet the Grams.
I don't know enough. Like, I never cared enough about Drake, I think, to really care. But I pissing off the modern Shakespeare, like, I'm there for the wordplay.
And Meet the Grams is a lot like Harley Warren kind of ripping out those eyes. Slowly dragging Drake's soul out of his body.
Nice.
In front of everybody.
Yeah.
And I'm combining these two for how, you know, prolific that battle was and the energy of this one, because I'm really loving where hip hop's at right now. And this latest round of diss tracks, 50 Cent, little known rapper. He had a debut classic, Get Rich or Die Trying. He has a Power series, etc. He's gone to war with another rapper from that early aughts, our high school era, T.I., popular act from that mid aughts. He recently had a comedy show turn and then has kind of returned back to rap with his debut. 50 and him get into it. It's not important why, but during this back and forth, what happens is important. As 50 is known to do, he starts posting unflattering pictures of T.I.'s wife. And this like sparks a whole battle between like the T.I. Harris's family as they stomp him out. They all come out the house and stomp him out. And T.I.'s family is very musically inclined, and they're even more upset to see their mother posted on socials having nothing to do with this battle at all. And it's really kind of sparked this whole ATL hip-hop community to like burn Fifth to the ground in a really interesting way. This track in particular like highlights the key mysteries in 50's past, where not only was his mother unduly killed in a house fire when he was a kid, under mysterious circumstances, Fifth's ex-wife and child experienced the same, not the same fate, but almost the start of the same fate of their
Jesus
house
Christ.
Being burned down on a random night. And this is after 50,
hip-hop beefs have gotten really fucking intense.
No, this is outside. Yeah. This is like personal
I know,
stuff.
But
we're bringing it in there.
To reference this is like, Jesus Christ.
So what's crazy about that, so Damani takes a very similar tactic to Dot Kendrick in that Meet the Grams song with the, you know, the You Lied vocals in the background, the you lied, whatever that happens in the Meet the Gram. Mm-hmm. And he does that here in a more melodic way with Firebug. He keeps repeating the term Firebug, but it has a little ATL kind of twang on it. And he's saying like, Firebug, we can still smell the gasoline on you, Firebug. At least let him sleep before you cremate him. Which
what
is,
the fuck?
When I heard that bar, I was like, oh my God, incredible writing.
It's like rolling in trauma. They're not even just like, they're just like, no, that thing that scarred you for life and your family. Now it's a mic drop. That's fucking
good
wild.
Lord.
So a lot of interesting punchlines, a lot of incredible writing. Really love this track. And is something that just came out of nowhere. T.I.'s son writing this, an artist I was previously unfamiliar with before this battle, I'm a big fan of now after hearing this track. I'm also a big fan of our guest today, Max Whalen, kicking it to him for his song. Max's song meant a lot to you while you were creating the film we're going to talk about a little later. Can you talk to us about this?
Yeah, so if you're not familiar with the folk singer Nick Drake, he was kind of the I guess he's like the sad boy, the sad boy's folk singer. Of sad boys, he was the sad boy.
He's in the a sad population boy, sad of just boy, sad yeah. boys. Speaking of early aughts music that was influential.
Yeah, I mean, you've probably heard
this isn't from the early aughts, but this is, I remember everyone in high school going through a Nick Drake phase for sure.
If you were a sad white boy with a guitar, you absolutely had a Nick Drake phase, for sure. But it's off his last album. I can't remember if this album was released after he had passed away. I can't remember.
He might have
released it and then passed. But I do know that this one was kind of the one that everyone thought was the weirder one. It was the album called Pink Moon, and the song is called Road, and it's really just this sort of melancholic song about functionally struggling with a type of depression and or trauma that you just can't get over, that, you know, that there's this part of you that's separating. One's going to stay on the ground and one's going to soar in the sky, that sort of thing. And it was thematically, I guess, emotionally, the sort of like fatalism of the song is kind of what I was leaning into for one of the core emotional elements of the film I made. And so that was the song. There's actually, it's not in the film, but there's a scene actually where there's a ballad between the brother and sister where he teaches her that song. We actually did a little bit of that song on a guitar thing. It's not in the movie, obviously, but there was a kind of it was played a lot on set.
To Shooting the Shit, this is Ian McGee shooting the shit about the ish they're effing with, and on today's episode we have special guest writer and director Max Whalen joining us to talk his latest work, Visions of Sonya Green, and then we're going to talk the first couple episodes of A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms, a Game of Thrones prequel, and we're going to end with a breakdown of Baby Keem's Casino album and the rollout that blew me away. But getting started up top here, we want to give Max all the praise and love. Thank you for joining us here on the podcast, Max.
Hell yeah.
I want to talk about Visions of Sonya Green because I was really blown away by this film, your latest work. I know how hard it is to try to put a film and get a film out. So the fact that you saw the vision through, which I know was, from what I'm gathering, maybe a little heartbreaking here. I want you to.
Yeah, it was a long process, but thank you. Thank you for having me on, and always, always the best time hanging with you guys.
Read the credits here in the
Yeah,
the law. Visions of Sonya Green is going to be available in our show notes. It's available on YouTube right now. We want you all to go check it out. It was the winner of the Best Adaptation Award at the 2024 H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival. Here's a log line if you're not familiar with this film. A film adaptation. A film adaptation of H.P. Lovecraft's Statement of Randolph Carter that follows Sonia Green, a local sheriff, as she investigates a mysterious man found near death at the side of the highway. Digging deeper, circumstances begin to link back to the disappearance of her brother years prior. As the truth unravels before her, a grand cosmic secret bridging thousands of years and miles is revealed. This is written and directed by Max Whalen. This is starring Dakota Shepherd as Sonia Green. Is it Andrew Caters or Craters?
Yeah, Caters.
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 As, Thomas Green. Andy Steinhauer, friend of the pod, as Randall Carter. Brad Herman as Harley Warren. And Chris Wolf as Howard. This is also shot by Jordan, is it Lanham?
Yeah, Jordan Lanham.
Production designed by Tracy Cummings. Art direction and monster design by Caitlin O'Shea, edited by Brad Elmore, and sound design by Will Denton. Right up top, I want to ask you, Max, let me jump in here before Sean gets a chance. Just say, what sparked this idea for you to adapt this work and for you to bring to screen?
Well, I have, I am nothing if not petty. And, and my brother, who was also a filmmaker, his first attempt at adapting, like making a horror movie, was an adaptation of The Statement of Randolph Carter. So naturally, younger brother style, I can do better. that's the fun answer. The real answer is actually it just kind of grew into. I originally had wanted to do a Statement of Randolph Carter adaptation because it was simple and relatively cheap to do. If you're familiar with the short story, it's exclusively the story of a guy who's talking about his buddy and him digging up essentially an old tomb, and then the guy vanishes, and he hears like a voice echoing up from the tomb that sounds like Warren, and he runs away screaming. It's like a 3-page short story. It's very basic, but it's kind of written in a dream language, which I always was really attracted to. It feels more like a dream than an actual occurrence. And so when I was adapting it, I just had the image of like what those cops would have done if they had just like actually gone to check it out. Like if they were just like, what the fuck happened up there? Like maybe we'll go look, cause this guy's clearly crazy. And so the initial idea actually was the ending. The ending is where the genesis was essentially a cop finding Harley Warren and whatever had become of Harley Warren in this tomb.
That's cool.
Yeah. So that was where the idea started. And originally it started as a short film. I was writing it to essentially pitch another sort of like cosmic horror idea. Mm-hmm. And here's where we're going to get into the forbidden secret lore. It grew and grew and grew. So this was originally and shot as a feature film.
Really?
This was a feature film and shot. It was 21 days in Wyoming and California. In which I pulled a Werner Herzog and drug a bunch of people from California up to a frigid Wyoming, like up in the Rockies in Wyoming, in the winter, in a town of like 60 people with no hospitals, no nothing.
The specificity of hospitals scares me.
Because if you've ever plotted, you know, plotting a production, that's like one of the things on your call sheet is where the
nearest,
you know,
the nearest hospital. It's like, well,
the nearest hospital was my mother, who's was the only EMT whose job it is, and I quote, to drag dead people off the mountain.
Okay.
That is like how my mom described her job.
That is a service that you might have needed. Yeah. So, you know.
Luckily nobody died. There was no like risk of that, but yeah, it was shot in 2019. Wow. So if you want to think about how long the post process was on it. So it was shot
as a feature.
It was a feature. The assembly cut is 2 hours and 15 minutes long.
Really?
Jesus.
I still have it. If there are any filmmakers, there are any filmmakers listening, and Sean will know this. Sean has knows this. Sean has emotionally experienced this. I have now probably because I've been humbled by life repeatedly. I had zero concept of scope and scale. As we constantly joke about shooting 10 pages in a 12-hour day, I was like, do you want to make a 2-hour movie with like four actors up in the mountains, go do it. Do you want to go make a 25-minute movie with practical effects and some cool things? Go do it. Do you want to make a period piece, like a 10-minute period piece? Go do it. When you're like, I'm going to do all of those. I'm going to go make a 2-hour period piece with practical monster effects with five people in the mountains. And we all collectively go insane. For 35K. Like, it was like, people were like, they spend that. I was like, I made like for 35K. It's insane.
Wow. Damn.
That we, you know, obviously everybody was getting paid in food. You know, no one's making a day rate. It's all favor movies. You know, it's all people. It's all favors on this. But like, yeah, we went up there. We went up there and yeah, it shot it like a feature. So this is the short film that we all see now is essentially the, I had no money left. COVID had just hit and there was no chance of getting any more money. And so it was, how much money could I assemble to do like the mastering, a 5-1 mix and finish it essentially. Right. And the answer was, a filmmaker who was the editor on it, was like, those are your two options pretty much. And he had come from the indie world. And he was like, you can do it. It's going to take you forever and it's going to cost a lot of money, or you can finish it for like 5K. Yeah.
Sean, did you want to jump in here? What can I?
Sorry, I feel like I gave you the background on a thing instead of pitching the movie. But you have to understand, I've seen this movie more than anyone should ever watch a movie. So I'm immediately just going to talk about, like, I've been having to deal with this thing in post for like 4 years. So it's like, you're just... I'm just immediately just like, all right, here's what it did. Here's where I fucked up.
I love it. I love it. And speaking of seeing this over and over and over, what struck me immediately is your first and last images are very, very striking. And I think that they're a mark of a great image maker. With every film, every project, I'm thinking like, what's the first image you're going to start with? What's the last image you're going to start with or end with? Excuse me. I'm curious what the thought process went in for your film in this one. We started a very wide with a person that looks like they're in distress in the foreground as a car sweeping into the back in the mid parking and someone's walking up to the foreground. And then we end on Sonia's face. Obviously her eyes at this point.
Yeah, that's the scene that was there from the very beginning. I had specifically that last shot was there from the very beginning. I had a very clear idea of that shot. The opening shot was pretty clear as well. Now I definitely scored that truck. I fucking love that old truck that we actually had a guy up in Wyandotte encampment who had that old truck to pull up. It's like the perfect truck for that. So that I couldn't account for, but I've gone up in those mountains. I grew up in those mountains. So I know that road. Mm-hmm. So I had a pretty clear idea of, you know, how it was going to look. The snow was perfect. Everything, the kind of bleak, it hit like sky horizon. It was the John Ford thing. It was like perfect. Yeah, yeah. You know,
you picked your fucking day. It's even like 21 day shooting schedule. Like, you picked your days fucking well, because the amount of snow cover that you got is the exact right amount. Like, it's just real fantastic, like high altitude shit. Like,
yep. Well, yeah, because you can see the descending tree line. There's no more trees because we're up at 10,000.
It just is placed so perfectly. Yeah. The imagery is really, really clean. But that was one of the things that I noticed on the rewatch where I was like, man, he really fucking nailed the weather on this. Like, that is somebody who, he definitely shot that where he grew up, because he picked the exact fucking days to get the imagery right.
Yeah.
Like,
and I looked at, you know, weather is, as all things, is unpredictable. But we did love, that was one of the things that swung hard in our favor. And the fact that the week leading up to it, we were at minus 15, which would not have been doable.
Oh God, no! Absolutely,
and
not.
It warmed up.
Especially
it warmed
those fucking
up to
LA
just a
kids.
Sunny.
There'd be like two people who came prepared.
Yo, yeah, and it warmed up to a sunny 3 degrees. No, which meant, and even then, if you couldn't tell, you probably can tell, but almost the entire film is ADR because we could protect the camera batteries, the sound batteries, and I was generally the sound guy. They lasted maybe about 5 minutes in that cold before they were dead.
Really?
So we were scamping just to try to get, the rigs that were set up to keep the camera batteries warm were wild. Like, it was a trip.
Look, like, is that just hand warmers.
Oh, it's hand warmers. It's driving cars and just having them run with heat. And like, you're literally got the heater of the car just blasting on these batteries. Like, because most cars, you know, it's difficult to run.
We would do beer coolers. I shot a movie in Big Bear where we were stuck. It was so cold. We had to special order tape because the adhesive was failing on the tape because it was freeze. It was below its operating temperature. So none of the tape, you would stick tape to things and it would just slide down.
Oh yeah. We had that with breakaway glass. We had that whole problem with break. We did some, you know, like the candy glass type stuff and that. Katie, who's the, who was the art director and did a lot of like the monster stuff as well as a lot of like, you know, the breakaway glass and stuff. Shout out to her. Her painting work on Fallout fucking kicks ass. So she's doing all the practical. Yeah, she's one of the painters for Fallout. So.
Hell yeah.
But we built this whole thing for breakaway glass and she just looked at me and was like, it's too cold. It just blew up. It like foamed over. Oh. Even just making it, they couldn't even get it to is so cold up there. So
yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. So
I saw Brad on the credits for as the editor too. I've been wanting to make Ewatch Bit at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bit's a good. Yeah, his trans vampire film, fantastic film.
Yeah, it's fucking fantastic. Yeah, I didn't realize he worked on the edit though. The edit's sharp as hell.
Yeah, he pretty much took my
looks fucking.
Yep. Yeah, he took my 86 minute cut and cut it down into like a digestible 20 some odd minutes, which was great. Damn.
How much were there like entire storylines missing or
almost all generally? Of Andy and Brad's. There's a lot more stuff that's from kind of the actual. So I cut most of the stuff that got cut was the stuff from the actual story itself.
Like, yeah.
The actual short story it's adapted from, which is, you know, there was stuff cut with them going up a lot more with them in the mountains, a lot more of them getting lost. Brad was the one who had come up with the idea of making, we call him Handsome Brad. Brad was the one who would come up with the idea of making Handsome Brad more like Orson Welles from The Third Man, like this sort of elusive figure you don't really see till the final point of the movie, which does work. I think there's some really good shit with him and Andy that got cut, but it works, I think. Oh, particularly in the short form where we're really just following the brother sister story.
Yeah.
Circling to that, I wanted to talk stylistic choices. I noticed that your present is devoid of color. Obviously, we're shooting this in black and white. And it seems like when we're in the past, we're going with color. I just kind of wanted to talk about your decision to handle it in that style. It was for ease of use or communicating, hey, easy shorthand, we're in the past, we're in the present here. What went into that decision?
Yeah, so most of that, we had originally done a desaturated but like rust look for the present. Specifically in the mountains, it was supposed to look very like rustic, but like bleak and desaturated. And then we were going to kind of do the California. We wanted to go California color with the flashbacks because most of the flashbacks all take place in California. So I wanted that kind of like, you know, the hazy hippie look.
It's like Kodachrome.
Yeah,
almost
exactly. Like, yeah. So I wanted the bright and I wanted you needed that kind of contrast to kind of stand out of these like. Better memories, this sort of like the warmth in her life is the memory of her brother. So it just narrative thematically fits kind of emotionally. But it just wound up looking better to just completely desaturate. And the way Jordan shot it, you know, sometimes when you're up there, it just like you have like one or two lights and that's all you're getting to deal with or play with. So lots of times if you just desaturate, you're not worried about like a lot more of the mistakes that can happen in color. And it
looks clean.
And then when like, we did it, looks like, fantastic. Yeah, it looked like True Detective shit in a way, even though True Detective's in color, it just has that like, it just looked, it was a better version of what we were trying to do anyway by making it bleak and like lifeless, just making it black and white fit that a lot better. And it made like a lot of the cave stuff at the end really land, which was actually the biggest scene I was bummed about losing the color in. Cause I just like, I really like fire color, like the warmth of fire color, but it works. I think the shadow play still works really well.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I think so.
But that was kind of what went in. So it was like all these things, some things are very clear at the beginning, but like, and obviously we were shooting this is not how you normally make a movie because I'm insane. but like, but like, you know, like usually these things kind of evolve. So some things, it's filmmaking and particularly directing for me, at least particularly at this level, is like trying to have a clear idea of the hills you're going to die on and know which, based on budget, scale, and the people you are with and how much they love you, is how many of those hills you get, essentially.
How are you deciding that? Is that something you're handling in pre-production? Is this something you're trying to have? Is that, or throughout the entire?
It's always throughout. Well, I mean, you do everything in pre-pro and you have an idea for how these things are going to go. As someone who was like direct, like approaching this, like I'm going to direct this giant epic, as someone who has never directed anything, but I'm going to act like I've directed everything, mm-hmm. kind of mentality, which is mm-hmm. insane.
Take it till you make it.
Yeah, you have no fucking idea. Well, no idea. I mean,
that's how everybody's yeah. working.
You're really winging it. But a lot yeah. of it is the moment you get there on day one. I mean, people were calling for me to cancel the shoot up until 8 hours before principal started because things were just, yeah, like things were going wild. There was a point where I was like, we're just gonna have to handhold this with like phones and shit. Cause there's
what kept you confident during all this? Like what kept you like
$12,000 had been spent. The machine was rolling.
It was pure sunk cost.
Yeah, fallacy. It was sunk cost fallacy. And I was like, I gotta wing this, you know, the talent is on the plane. Like they're flying out of Atlanta and out of LA. They're here. Like it's happening. Another part of it was just kind of, you know, pure hubris. And the idea of really thinking that, this is why talking about making movies is so insufferable, probably to people who have to listen to people talk about making movies, but also the process itself is, the reason it got made is the same reason where I see a lot of the failures, at least in the process of making it, or what I've learned from the process. Cause you kind of have to be in, it's understanding by what boundaries you get to be insane. that's really it, because
right. yeah.
there are so many ways now, as you're there on the day, you're making concessions constantly, particularly at this budget level where shit's just not working. I mean, your frame yeah. is no longer dictated by your frame. Your frame is where the edge of the money, where the money stops, is where your frame
yeah,
is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like, so there's a lot of stuff in there where the edge of the, and we're just winging it. I mean, the cult scene yeah. That's up at Pisgah Crater in California, with it's up effect. In the volcano crater. that is four extras showed up and we just started giving people wigs.
Are you serious?
I had a whole like wide shots of like, people being like doing flower child shit and all this hippie stuff, and we there's nobody.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. I picked the wrong
yeah.
scene.
Yeah, the scene okay. where Thomas's foot grows back.
Gotcha.
No extras that day. Like nobody showed. So like we just throw grab wigs randos. On. Yeah, that's why you don't yeah. see the cult leader either. Originally, you saw the cult leader, but the wig was so bad we could only shoot. We could only see him from the back.
I want to talk about a few shots that actually were worth, I mean, these are great, honestly.
Oh,
I just text you the, what I thought prior was the extra cult scene where they're crucifying a baby or.
Oh shit. You like this shot? I am so flattered. Do you want to know what I hate about this shot that makes me crazy? So what you're looking at is the crew and my mother.
oh, that makes it so much better.
Shout out to our thespian, our local thespian, the leader who is doing all the crazy shit there. That's Andy.
Really?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, the guy who pulls the baby out. That's Andy. but like, I fucking can't.
What a champion.
I can't stand the fact that they're all just wearing modern clothing under their burlap
sacks.
It makes me insane. It makes me so fucking crazy. And we tried, man. We tried.
No one is looking at
that. No, see, this is the thing. This is the famous Kubrick thing. The whole, like, you know, what Sidney Pollack talks about Kubrick being a famous cheat. For as a perfectionist, as he was constantly moving shit in the background because he didn't like the way it looked. Right, and they're like, but continuity. Yeah. And it's like, no one is, if they're in, they're not going to notice this shit. But when you've watched it for 4 years, I'm slowly understanding why Fincher's a monster. I get it. I do. I really, like, it makes you pathologically insane because you watch it so much. You're just like, you start to have like a trauma response on the day, where now when you're on set, there's like one thing and they're like, no one's going to notice that. It's just like, I do. That's all that matters.
That along with your transition, I'm going to say are absolutely worth it. And even if you, I mean, the clothing underneath, I think it's the composition, the pose,
the shot's great.
It's lit. It's really one of the more successful things that, and along with the ocean line transition into the ink blot shit, dude. Talk to us about the ink blots. Talk to us about the special effects work.
I am so glad that you like that. So very quickly, it turned out like some of the broader special effects, and I was trying to keep it as practical as possible. If I don't know if either of you are familiar with the Italian film The Visitor.
You've mentioned it actually once or twice, I want to say.
I might have. Yeah, it's got like Sam Peckinpah's in it and John Huston's in it. It's got like a bunch of weird directors that are in it for whatever reason, but it's kind of this alien Jesus horror movie that kind of rips off The Omen a little bit, but it's like, but there's this crazy opening scene that is like some of the best, just like, not, we're not even going to bother hiding that this is ink tank shit, but it just looks so psychedelic and cool. Like we're just leaning into it. And so I was like, the more I realized we had to abstract, which I think was better in the long run than probably what I had originally intended, like a much more abstract concept of like this cosmic force or presence.
Yeah.
I started to lean in very, very, very hard into just like, we're just going to do ink effects. And that was a thing that was a Brad thing that he did in the edit where he was able to overlay those. Cause both of those kind of like dissolved into each other, but he was able to like actually like composite it in a way that made it really horizons meet in a way that really worked. But that was, now you know what I did during COVID. Cause that was my kitchen, setting up and doing all those ink tank effects. So
they look great. You nailed it.
Yeah, it was good stuff. It was,
the effects look great. That edit is fucking fantastic. That's so funny that it's Brad. I was really happy with this watch. It's nice. I think Andy and Brad had the hardest task as performers, especially in the 20-minute cut.
Yeah.
Where they are kind of bringing in so much of that original story.
They had a rough go.
they have the hardest job of everything, but I fucking love it, man. I was really happy watching it. I think the grade is fantastic. The imagery is fantastic. I am kind of curious to see the, and like at least like the 85 minute cut. maybe the two and a half,
no one's watching the 2 hour cut. That's an assembly cut. That's just like, that's not a cut anyone's watching.
It's between you and Brad.
Okay, so what is me and God what's one of your darlings that you cut out of the edit?
And good question.
I'm just gonna say right now, because of what the scene is, Sean does not know about this, and this was not an easy layup for me to talk about it.
Okay.
But I'm going to tell you, there is a fellatio scene with a tentacle on a penis in the woods during the cult scene. That was my darling. And the only reason it's gone is because the fake penis looked too fake because of how cold it was. It looked rock hard, like fake rock hard. But there is a fellatio scene in that cult scene. There was a whole like
shit.
Yeah, there was a whole like, I call originally when I pitched
I'm
it,
so
I was
glad
just
I
like,
asked.
This is the water. I called it the festival water cooler scene. Like, so I'm like, no matter what people think about the movie, they're going to be like, do you remember when the penis vagina gave a cult member fellatio? That's all that matters.
I take back all the nice things I said about Brad's edit.
because that scene was.
I don't care how weird it looked. We needed that scene in there.
Yeah, that scene was definitely truncated. I have a really funny story about where, so I'm the body double in that. So I'm just, you can't see me, but I'm like, I got a burlap sack and this fucking strap on with this fake penis. And like my roommate at the time and one of my best friends, Katie, is the one who's like pumping. Like, and we're trying to keep the cream warm enough because it's so cold in the middle of the night. And she's pumping it. It was a funny moment. It was a funny moment. Yeah, it was a good one of those weird movie moments where, and then I'm like, now I'm standing there doing all this. My mother, I can look down out of the wood, out of the trees, and I see in the house, I see my mother standing there squatted with her arms on her hips, just blitzed on wine, because she was just blitzed every night we were up there. When she had to deal with these LA kids, she was just hammered the whole time.
But yeah,
she's
just I would
there,
be too.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm just like, I hope she can't see what's happening right now, as I've got like this weird pseudo. Anyway, yeah. Well, yeah, there's a whole
lot.
Like,
oh, this is why he's here. Yeah, now I get it.
Yeah, yeah.
I love this. Let me hit you with your couple more questions before we go out.
No.
Worst day on set.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God.
I mean, if you want to relive that.
You know what? The problem with that question is, and this is like, I'm not even being that hyperbolic, is that I genuinely don't remember moments in.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't sleep for like 3 months. And so I don't I really don't remember much, because I was functioning on the shoot as UPM director,
right.
Aide, you know, I'm the taskmaster and the creative. So I'm trying to think what, I mean, every day I definitely remember walking into a room and having Jordan, like everybody on set, groan because and literally say he wants something. I remember that. I remember that being, that was on the beach. Actually, I remember that. That was on the beach. I do remember getting flack by people, cause it was an open beach. We just paid to shoot there, and just getting flack where they're just like, beaches for everybody. Like, I got people walk by just giving a shit for making a movie there. Yeah. So there was that, but no, it was,
So you were in Southern California then.
Yeah.
That
you're sense. Just in SoCal, but no, for me, it was like,
that's the only place that experience happens. Anybody else shooting a movie anywhere else, they're like, oh, cool. What are you doing? In SoCal, they're like, fuck you for trying, bitch. Give me some money.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty much. I think, to be honest with you, I'm really trying to think. It's mostly just funny stories and things that people have told me in retrospect. It sounds like when I talk to people who worked on it, they do seem like they had fun, which I'm glad they did. They had a good time. I don't remember much, but it was the worst day was the day that I watched the cut.
Oh.
That was the worst day. That was definitely the day of, that was like the, that's where the pure weight of every decision you've ever made and this whole, like the whole,
it's like, I'm going to have to make some tough, this has been a series of tough calls, yeah. And it's, they're getting tougher.
Are you watching that with your editor? Or are you watching that by yourself? How are you experiencing?
No, I was the editor. I was the sole editor. So I was cutting up until that point. And then when Brad and Will, who was the sound designer, when they gave me the short version, you know, my initial reaction is just seeing everything that's not there. And I was just like,
yeah,
I was like, this is an alien. This is an alien film to me now.
Yeah,
it's completely unfucking recognizable.
Like, this isn't my baby.
This isn't my baby.
This is a changeling.
Can you dive right back into the edit? How much separation do you need after seeing that first cut to like, okay, I have the courage now to kind of go fix this and at least pull the Michelangelo out of this fucking stone? Like,
I think what I did initially, I definitely know for a fact I was diving into the ink tank stuff. I went into a lot of the post ink tank doing experimenting and just trying to get good stuff out of the ink tank tests. Right. I think that was my coping mechanism was... Mm. You know, and you kind of have a better idea of like where you can see it, where you need it, mm-hmm. where the transitions need to be and all that kind of stuff. So I think it was definitely how much time.
That's really smart. Yeah. Honestly. Like
how much time? I mean, it's very strange because like I think I finally came. To be honest with you, I really do think I didn't really come like have a moment of peace with that movie. Mm-hmm. Until I saw it on the big screen in Portland, when I saw it on that big 70 millimeter screen at the festival, at the Lovecraft Film Festival. I think that's kind of where it came around. Cause for me, the, I defend the last scene of the movie. I think the last scene, it came out almost exactly as how I imagined it. It was one of those moments where brain and execution matched the most, the Hell closest. Yeah. And it's also the scene that's the least like cut down and truncated. And so like when that landed, I was just like, all right, dog, you're okay.
You know what?
I mean, I was hammered for most of the festival, but you're like, I'm all right. It's okay.
I will be honest with you, right around there, or it's kind of when the surrealism is really, we really got to kick it up a notch. I was like, fuck, now we're getting into some Max shit.
I knew that
that's where the turn was going. And it was like, oh, so we got up to the cave. I'm already kind of like wincing and looking. And I was like, I was both parts, you know, disgusted and intrigued as I'm watching it. But I'm like, I could see all the episodes, the conversations, like the tone, like that's, there he is.
Yep. I hope both of you felt that I linger on that fireplace shot. I intentionally so. This was a very intentional editorial thing that I did that Brad kept, which was, I thank him for, which was, I linger on that fire probably a good second and a half longer than it feels natural, just to make you know what's coming, that it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
That's like one of my big like editorial. I wanted that. I wanted to linger on that fire a little too long.
Stretch the moment. And, yep. Yeah.
And that was, and you, if you want to know, like that was the scene where that shoot day, that was the day where I broke that was the day where I did the director thing where I'm like, we're going 14. And
really,
yep. And I mean, keep in mind that that's also transit time. Mm-hmm. That's transit because that's driving out to Pisgah, which is about an hour and a half, 2 hours. Mm-hmm. But I will say I am a kind God because I did cancel the shoot day the next day. I just straight up canceled it instead of doing like a forced call. I was like, no, everyone goes home. Everyone goes home.
Yeah.
So
but this is such an incredible short.
Thank you. It really means a lot. If it's weird. It's a weird little movie. And it's narratively kind of wonky and kind of strange and, you know, David Lynch-y, which is, you know, which is good. So, but if it hits you, particularly with, you know, I was really trying to get across some of the, you know, like the emotional stuff is the stuff, you know, and we always, you know,
the motion get and better. The tone really comes across. Like I get Big Edgar vibes from this. I was like, I can see what, like you given the budget and your talent and like what you would want. Like I can kind of see like, 10 years ahead, like the shit that you'd be doing.
I'm that's like, okay. I appreciate that. And I got the best, post premiere note from my future wife.
Oh, yeah?
Who had cat ears and came up to me after I had won an award and asked what I won the award for. And I told the Visions of Sonya Green, and she said, that is the worst film I have ever seen. And I asked her to marry me there. And then she just walked away. But anyway,
that's Max Whalen. His film Visions of Sonya Green is available right now on YouTube for free. It is an awesome short. Please go support independent filmmakers, support your artists, support your local artists, support Max here. Great interview. Max, you sticking around for the other two things you got coming up here?
I'm always down to clown. Down to clown, as they say.
We are talking about a clown, huh? In this Game of Thrones, Seven Kingdoms coming up after this.
Is there a clown?
It's kind of clownish, buffoonish. Sir Dunk, he was going with it, trying to make
ass out of him. He's clownish. Okay.
This is kind of a clown, yeah. I mean, he's an endearing, endearing lad.
I was squire to Sir Arlen of Pennytree since I was a boy. He charged me to be a good knight. Defend the weak and the innocent. And I swore that I would.
Are you Baelor Targaryen?
No.
Then would you move the fuck out of the way? Yeah,
sorry.
What's your name?
Sir Duncan the Tall.
Never heard of him.
Do you know every knight in the Seven Kingdoms then?
The good ones. If you could bring me to Ashford, I could squire for you, sir.
Rob me, and I'll hunt you down with dogs.
You don't have dogs!
I'll get some.
Where?
Who?
Boy, stop gaping. Sit on my horse.
I'm not a stable boy, my lord.
Not clever enough.
I know I'm just a hedge knight, but sometimes I think there could be more.
Why do you treat these royal lap dogs like they're your betters?
They are my betters.
These men have a name. I'm training. What chance do I have?
I have no chance.
Falling star brings luck to those who see it.
So the luck is ours alone. I need to fight honorably. But sometimes I think I buried my courage alongside the old man.
And in every man, there are many men. So be brave. Be just. Be tall.
You know what?
My whole fucking mic stand was falling during this. You guys just give me 2 seconds.
I was wondering why you went into chill handheld mode.
You almost made me jealous. You almost made me think that like I was just like, oh, I guess he goes handheld when we're not talking about my movie. What is your shirt, by the way? It's like clearly a one battle after another play, but
one small beer.
That's good. That's good.
I also was jealous of his shirt.
That's a good.
I didn't get to make the reference while we were talking, but I still want to tell you it anyway. The vibe that I got is my favorite kind of like. My personal growing up Lovecraftian influence is all like old horror comics, like Strange Tales shit.
Oh yeah, the real weird fiction side of it for sure.
Yeah. So like I can absolutely picture everything that you were doing in this just like in my brain stylized as like a Strange Tales comic.
Hell yeah, that's cool.
Like the big blocks of yellow text and shit, like
yes, excellent.
Like all of the dialogue easily could have been in big blocks of yellow text over like just horror.
Yeah, just weird, like a gaunt gothic imagery and like weird. Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
that's exactly. Hell yeah. So that's I thought the note that you that you would appreciate.
Thank you. I do. Yeah, that's hell yeah. that's the vibe.
All right, so that was from the trailer of A Knight of Seven Kingdoms, a Game of Thrones prequel. Here's the log line. A century before GOT, or Game of Thrones, Sir Duncan the Tall and his squire Egg wandered through the Westeros while the Targaryen dynasty ruled the Iron Throne and dragons were still remembered. Great dynasties and enemies await these incomparable friends. Sean's getting a big laugh out of me saying Targaryen.
You're such a king, Eric.
Hey, you did it. You fixed it, though.
Yeah.
You did.
How did I say it the first time? I thought I said Targaryen.
I think you said Targaryen.
You said Targaryen, then you did Targaryen.
Oh, my bad. All right. Actually, let me take that.
No, you fixed it. That's all good. No,
I think it's better that way. Hell yeah.
Okay. All right. Episode 1. We're going to talk about the pilot premiere, episode 1, entitled The Hedge Knight. This is directed by Owen Harris. Photographed by, I think it's Gustav Danielsson. Written by Ira Parker, created by Ira Parker and George R. R. Martin, based on Martin Short's The Hedge Knight. Yeah. So season 1, episode 1, The Hedge Knight. McGee, what do we think? You put this on my radar real early. Seems like something you were excited to talk about. What were your
I've been loving watching this series. The first season's completed at the time of recording. And I feel like this would be... I know you didn't really watch Game of Thrones, am I correct?
No, I watched the first episode and I heard about the Red Wedding and that's about all I know.
Okay. I mean, good enough. But yeah, I felt like this was good enough of a standalone and it's just like pretty good vibes for the most part. Obviously, like, you know, not the entire time. But it's a nice comfort show. I think that it's also interesting the scale and scope of the story that they're telling, the way that it's like kind of focuses in. We're not doing like this big sweeping political drama like Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon is the other spinoff, where it's much more like Game of Thrones, where we're still doing like big battles and political drama and backstabbing and different point of views and yada, yada, yada. Like, this one is just like pretty much just Dunk. You're just with Dunk all the time. And it's not a story about like life and death. Well, I mean, life and death, yes, but not like these like giant political wars being started and stuff. It's just like, a weekend that he had one time. And so it's interesting how compelling and just fun it is. And so I thought, I just wanted to see, put this on your radar, especially as somebody that I knew was one of the few people in America that didn't really watch any Game of Thrones at any point. Yeah, and see if this one hit you.
I knew about those White Walkers.
I mean, yeah. Especially given your love of A Knight's Tale.
Yeah, you know what? So, yeah, you got me. I wanted to ask you right up top, because there's a question you asked me way back in the day. Why shit on the audience in the first 5 minutes of the movie? what you quoted. It's going to be slight spoilers. Obviously, Max not familiar with this. In the first 5 minutes of this, there's a very interesting scene that was a direct parallel to Babylon, at least in timing and structure. Very curious as to why this worked for you better here than in Babylon, a scene that you noted as being a complete turnoff immediately when we were in that movie.
I'll be honest, I don't love it. I don't love it. I think, especially like watching it live as each like new episode week to week, there is kind of a gag that they do in each episode that is very engineered for social media. Mm-hmm. Of like, this week we're all going to talk about the just ass shitting fart, just shit being rocketed out of an ass on whatever size television you had, that you maybe didn't consent to having that image blown up that large in front of you. But sure enough, just shit rocketing out of an ass. So they kind of continue that kind of shocking imagery that I think successfully captured the social media from week to week of the show, kind of gave a talking point to talk about. So it felt intentional. I didn't love it, but the rest of the show I loved so much that I will forgive it for playing into the game, because, hey, the fucking game's hard. And we were talking about like budget shit before. Like, this show had like less money because obviously it's only 6 episode long season as well, but they also had less money like per minute of the show than the other Game of Thrones shows. So they're trying to like stay true to the look of that universe and really pay homage and respect to like this history that's been laid out for them already, but like trying to make it work on, obviously it's HBO show, so like they still have fucking, they got a lot more than what Max was dealing with. But to some degree, to like try and match that level of something that felt like it had a blank check before, and this time in this economy, they're like, no, you do not. You have a this is your budget.
What was the budget per episode?
It was I don't have the number on top of me, but I know it was, I think it was like half of what House of the Dragon had.
Oh wow, okay, sure.
Yeah, so while we're pulling up the budget, I'm just going to get into my reaction, because I was really surprised by how much I enjoyed this. Like I said, McGee hit me up earlier in the week, and he thought it would be on my bag. I couldn't for the life of me imagine why until I realized this was another version of The Knight's Tale, complete with a would-be knight in, you know, search of status. This felt very much like latter-day Coen brother work for me, like particularly like Buster Scruggs for whatever reason. Patient but biting. It's like really patient in the tone, the setup, and I think the ease of simplicity. Like we're given small little tasks and goals that he's completing, you know, and we're kind of just trudging along here. But then it cuts and it bites with these like smash edits, like Back to the Past. And you're just like these little incidents that they'll reference, almost like in a Family Guy type of way, where we're just cutting away to like whatever that incident is and then cutting right back into the present. I liked it a lot. I for whatever reason, Peter Caffley, who is... Yeah, who's our lead, and he's pretty much carrying the entirety of the first episode. he has a, he's a very reserved performer. I'm anticipating the rest of the season to see where we go with that. I'm not sure if all six episodes are resting on his shoulders. I'm very curious if the lack of charisma, oh shucks, me kind of take is gonna really work and keep you engaged for 6 hours. It seems like he has there some different shades when we're dealing with Dexter Soul Asneel as Egg, and this is the child performance. I really fucking love Egg. Now his entire.
I thought you were gonna be the other way around. Gonna bitch about the kid. That's so funny.
He's incredible, and this is he's like a little helper sire boy that wants to help Sir Duncan, Peter's character in this film, and Peter reluctantly, you know, shepherds him along. But he has a very cut, dry, no nonsense, you know, wiser than his years kind of take that we've seen in child performances. But it's not as precocious. It doesn't feel as annoying in other ones that I've seen. So I'm really looking forward to see their dynamic of him kind of being more of the adult than Peter actually, or than
they
Dunk
have
actually
such
is.
Good chemistry. Yeah.
I like that back and forth. So hoping nothing happens to this kid as fucking Game of Thrones, George R. R. Martin stories are wont to do. Max, yeah. Any what are your thoughts about the series thus far? Something you're excited about? Something you?
Yeah, it was. It's
in?
Number one on my list to check out when I get HBO. Or when I go back to HBO, it'll be the first thing I watch. I'm vaguely familiar with the story. Sure. And so it's got like a lone wolf and cub thing, which I always like.
Yeah, that's another one. That's a great, another
reference. And it's always, I'm a big fan of.
I don't even know why that didn't occur to me. Now that you just said that.
I also just genuinely like when we take. And I mean, this is from a property that George R. R. Martin already had done, so it's not like someone doing something new with it outside of what he already did. But I do like tone changes within these like universes that we're creating. If we're going to live in these universes, you might as well just lean into the tone. I mean, like there's a reason why Andor is what Andor is. Like lean into the bit and just do something different. It doesn't need to be exactly what you expect when you come to a Game of Thrones property. You know, it's not Walmart.
I love the way that they weaponize the. Oh, neither of you have seen that yet. but they weaponize the theme music from Game of Thrones. I mean, they kind of do it in the first episode with the because he. I guess Eric wouldn't have gotten that joke, but so right before I'm like, oh shit, Max hasn't seen it, and Eric wouldn't have gotten that because he didn't watch a lot of Game of Thrones, but. They start swelling up the Game of Thrones theme music as he's like, and they're giving him the like angle up hero shot, and then they smash cut to him just violently shitting.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that's
he's like leaned up against a tree, and he's just like looking up, just trying to not think about how much he's just shitting his guts out.
That's very okay. So it's very
they use the build up of the music like to play off of the expectation.
That's a good way to make it. It's in the same world. We're showing you brutal reality. It's just not what you were expecting in terms of.
It's just
going to
be a much different version the brutal Game of Thrones that you're used to. I'm excited to talk about the rest of the show with you. Yeah, go on.
Is it there's no humor really in Game of Thrones, or is there any kind of, how much of the humor that we see in this show translates to the original series?
There's a lot of humor in the original series. It's just the general tone is brutal.
Yeah.
And this show gets pretty brutal. I'm not going to lie. Like, I finished the season. The ending is rough. Also, just a tease, like the episode 5 has the best like historical European martial arts fight scene I've ever seen in anything. Like, it's incredible. I have, you know, criticisms that we'll talk about, I'm sure, but like it's incredible. The intensity, the way it's shot is just fucking amazing. But yeah, so I'm excited to talk more about this fucking series. We definitely should.
Well, now I gotta watch it. So now it's time for me to watch it.
Hell yeah. And that is A Knight of Seven Kingdoms, a Game of Thrones prequel available on HBO.
Oh, I just had one anecdote that I forgot to mention that I liked really a lot. The guy who plays Seeley Pate, who's the armorer that I don't think is probably in this first episode. But he was telling an anecdote from set where one a character is like having a big entrance and he's like there for eyeline, but he's not on camera at all. And he said he was just off screen humming the Game of Thrones theme, just going, no, 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 no. And one of the other actors like patted him on the shoulder and just goes, every fucking day, mate. Just like, I'm doing it too.
Oh, that's funny.
I'm just humming it in my head every fucking day. And like, but that was part of what they said, kind of the magic of the set was a lot, because they just shot it in the same, like a lot of the same like Irish locations that Game of Thrones shot in. So a lot of the actors that got cast were people who auditioned for Game of Thrones and never got the role.
Oh,
so
cool.
It was a lot of like people who like really knew the world and were really hungry for it and were finally being given a chance to like take a swing at it. And so the vibe on set was really like celebratory and like there's just a lot of camaraderie. And so that just kind of translates into the way that the show's tone is a little bit more like joyful and about like the chemistry between the people and everything. So it just, it really, it, I think they really got a special season of television out of this. Like, it's very fun.
Awesome.
I like that.
I need to watch it.
And that was HBO, A Knight of Seven Kingdoms. That seems like they took a pretty big swing and giving them a budget for 6 episodes first season. Pretty big gamble.
Oh, God. I didn't even mention the budget.
Just
to answer your question.
Oh, yeah. Was it 2.5?
They had $6 million per episode to House of the Dragons, like 18 to 20.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
So they have less than a third of House of the Dragons.
That's six. That might just be the way it's going forward in the modern, the post Duffer Brothers world, I think, right now.
All right. So that was from A Knight of Seven Kingdoms, a Game of Thrones prequels from HBO. They took a pretty big swing on them, pretty big gamble. We're going to talk about another one. In Casino, an album from Baby Keem, coming up after this.
So this is the diary of Lakani Govan. So y'all better get it right. Picture a girl as beautiful as this, making everybody dizzy as they see this. A filmmaker stepping to the scene, ain't worried about nothing, but all eyes is on me. See what I'm saying? I grew up around here in Long Beach, where Ashley Gardena, born and raised out here. Well, hi, I'm lying to y'all. I was born and raised in Chicago, and then the rest of my life, I spend my days out here in California. Seeing back of me, that's my nephew. You know what I'm saying? Get a picture of him. But that's the little G right there. You see what I'm saying? That's the G. Boo Man. Hey, Boo Man. Turn him around, BJ.
Do rag activity, do rag activity, do rag activity, do rag activity. Extension, that's your big stench. Big stench, that's your big stench.
Well, let's just start right there. Baby Keem is on the program, man. What's up, bro?
How you doing?
I'm chilling, man. It's good to meet you.
I just got the flight, man. So
from LA?
Yeah, from LA.
Straight to here.
Straight here.
Listening to your production, which is where I want to start the convo before we get into the artist part, because I feel like you've done a lot of work in the production part, which set the stage for the artist part. Am I understanding it right?
Yeah, for sure.
So,
for sure.
And the reason I say that, and I tie that to catching a vibe or sipping on something or drinking, is what is, like, how do you zone out when you're trying to create, right? Because some people will say, I zone out. You know, some people might just be like, look, I'll be at the beach listening to the ocean. That's all I need. Or, you know, I drive around and just look at the world. Some people doing way more than they need to be doing to figure out how to create. What's your thing?
My thing is, like, I don't really leave that mode. Like, I feel like when I go home, everything I do is for the sake of the music.
Really?
So if I go, like, watch a movie, or if, you know what I'm saying, if I play a video game, I'm studying, like, something. There's something in there that I could use, like, especially, like, a movie, for sure, like...
King my semen. If I'm in this bitch, then I'm ready to crash out. I'm holding resentment. My mama's so petty, she left me in back of the stash house. I packed out the building. If you at the show, then that mean that you ready to black out. That mean that it's too late to back out. The cameras is all about to act now.
Walking in a party, I don't feel no party. What the fuck? Powered up. Who gon' stop me?
Turn down the doubles on. What the fuck?
Bus and I'm what the fuck?
What the fuck? Powered up. Yeah, turn those down.
Walking in a party, I don't feel no party. What the fuck?
All right, let's get freaky with it. Give me top of my verse real quick. Top of the second verse. Take the first note of the piano.
I keep my semen. If I'm in this bitch, then I'm ready to crash out. I'm holding resentment. My mama's so petty, she left me in back of the stash house. I packed out the building. If you had to show, then that mean that you ready to black out. That mean that it's too late to back out. The cameras is all about to act now. I pack up your tribe. I still got the stripes. Gorilla, you stopping that high key. She's feeling alive. The music is right. I fold that girl up like karate. Got two at a time. You blew up the spot. It's time you get beat from the lobby. I find me a new carbon copy. Cause you out here moving too sloppy.
Walking in a party. I don't feel no party. What the fuck? Powered up. Who gon' stop me?
All right. So that was from Casino, an album from Baby King. I'm also going to talk about the... album rollout and the Boo Man documentaries, Boo Man episode 1, 2, and 3. Here's a log line for at least the album rollout. This is the second studio album by American rapper Baby Keem. It was released by PG Lang, Kendrick's company or Kendrick's imprint, and Columbia Records on February 20th of 2026. This album features guest appearances by Kendrick Lamar, Too Short, Mama Boyd, Infinity Song, and I think it's Che Ikru. Forgive me if I mispronounced that last name. I didn't necessarily connect all that strongly with Baby Keem's first album, The Melodic Blue, outside of Kendrick Dodd, his cousin, and the Big Family Ties record. I just didn't necessarily, it was a double album, 24 songs, didn't necessarily, it just wasn't my vibe. I'm a little older, I mean, Keem's like, you know, half my age at this point, so it's a lot of little, like, young, turn up kind of stuff. I'm just not in that stage of life, so this didn't connect with me. But this project, and this, it's a 5-year gap between that and this, I really did connect to. And I think by the 3-part documentary that came out, that sort of led into the rollout of this one, was really, really special. And I'm really excited to talk about this. Are you guys familiar with Aunt Connie? Either of you guys familiar with Aunt Connie?
I am not.
No.
I wasn't either. It was Baby Keem's aunt who starts off the documentary with...
I love that.
With home shot footage. And in this home shot footage, and they have hours and hours of her just shooting Keem, his aunties, their migration from Long Beach to Las Vegas. And they make this trek. For a number of different reasons, obviously the community where they were at was you know, it's tough growing up where they were at. They thought Vegas would be a little cheaper, a little bit more family friendly. They end up finding out that that's, you know, wasn't necessarily the case either, but that took a little longer. How she starts this documentary, which I think is so special, and I'm going to tag this at the end, is not only where they're at, that transition, but her hopes and dreams, and what you come to find out is she wished to be a filmmaker. She wished to be a writer, director. She says in the documentary, you know, I'm going to be a famous writer, I'm going to be a famous director, but you know how this goes. And what's so interesting about that, this was shot in like 2002, 2003 or something like that, or at least the Chiron at the bottom of the footage. You know, so she's saying this, and you almost, I'm not even sure if she believes it as she's saying it, but she couldn't foresee that fucking 27 years later, the child that she rescued from Long Beach was going to be the one that would put her footage out here and kind of make her the filmmaker, the documentarian that she wanted to be. It was so special. It was so heart-wrenching to kind of see that. One of the big themes of the album is the strip in the street. And that's not a quote original from me. I'm going to credit Screwface John, who's another YouTube rapper, podcaster, blah, blah, blah. And he's a Vegas resident. And I think what he kind of clued a lot of the hip-hop community in on is this album will turn from some real hyphy, turn-up, you know, rah-rah shit to some real, like, deep, introspective, gut-wrenching, fucking, when you get into it.
Yeah.
And he was kind of cluing you in on is that's sort of the vibe of Vegas. And what the tourists might not catch is, you know, you're in these glitzy, you know, you're on the strip, you're in these glitzy hotels, you're at these shows like that, but you turn the corner and there's just abject poverty. And it just like these two slant, like you're walking out of your hotel with these highs and then you're hit with these immediate lows. And that's kind of what residents of Vegas were experiencing. And I just thought it was just an interesting thing. I just never really, and one of the big things I love about hip hop and particularly with Max going back into the 90s is these regional sounds, and you knew where artists were from based on their sounds, what their stories were from based on, you know, like I could tell what an Outkast song was and what Atlanta sounded like in the mid 90s. I knew what, you know, Biggie sounded like in the mid 90s. So like New York had a sound, Atlanta had a sound, California had a sound. And so for Vegas here, like this is what that tonality is, the smashing of emotions. I found to be really, really enlightening. I want to talk about the opening of the, album listening party. So what he does is they rent out a space, and what PG Lang is doing with this rollout is amazing, not only with these documentaries, but the night of the album drops. We have this live sort of stream of the actual album, and Baby Keem is not necessarily performing all of the album, but they're acting out bits. It's almost like an expressionist live theater kind of performance where it's like this is the emotive quality of the song. So we have this hyphy turn up shit with a mime from, you know, another black content space, RDC World. We have one of the characters from RDC World involved in this, and we're just kind of all turning up in this group, like with the title track of the album. It's just really interesting stuff like that really kind of that I found interesting. I thought Thought Crimes, which is another social thing, I'm name dropping a lot of things here, but they put it best with this had the best of like Ye's Donda rollout and the Kendrick pop out event kind of mixed together with this album. And I just thought it was such a unique, interesting way to sort of engage your fans listening to the album, because we're all anticipating it that night and we're tuning into this live series, and you're getting a visual along with listening to the project. And it was just really interesting stuff. What else do I want to say? The album itself, it may be a Gen Z classic. I'm two generations removed, but just based on hearing molding Keem's story from those documentaries and then hearing the music coming out of this, what a lot of this album is going to be is about family and Keem's relationship to his mother, who was an addict for a long time. Based on his stories, it's just still one today that he's sort of battling with getting rehabilitating. But there are lyrics, and he has a clean out your closet, like heart-wrenching, like Birds Don't Sing, that it was in the Clips album, kind of like feeling with the last song, No Blame, where he kind of speaks directly to his mom about having, you know, I don't blame you for these things. Obviously, you were going through your own trials and tribulations in Chicago, moving to Long Beach, and, you know, we were too poor to address those issues and find your rehabilitation, that kind of spilled over. So I kind of understand, I'm in a position of understanding. But there's a lyric in here. Oh, there's a lyric in here that fucking brings me to tears, makes me cry, where he... in that No Blame, so he keeps saying, he keeps repleting No Blame, you know, I don't blame you for this, I don't blame, but he said, smoking in the house made it haunted, which is a visual and a tone and a lyric that just like, and if you've ever been, not the YouTuber, but if you've ever been in these sort of situations in these homes, like when people are just casually smoking in the house and there's this depression that sort of just lays with the house, like how that bar right there, oh, sent me. Love the writing in here is incredible. The beats are incredible. What I wanted to talk to you guys about, and I was so inspired in terms of this rollout, was can this not work in a way for film? And what I want to, so we have a lot of outlets for different filmmakers after the fact. You know, we have the Variety, you know, scene on the scene, or we have like Actors on Actors, or the GQ, Five Things I Can't Live Without, with your artists or your filmmakers, your directors. But you don't, there's not a lot of alternative audience engagement outside of the trailer and maybe a special clip or two that Warner Brothers would put out. Actually, you know what? Fuck them. We're not mentioning them. Anybody will put out like 30-second making of clip.
Yeah.
But it's not like the, like other independent acts, say like Kevin Smith, when he had like an independent touring thing with one of his films at one point, and mm-hmm. I'm hitting these different
cities. Yeah, you're talking about, Tusk. Yeah, he did that with Tusk.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to build
was,
up
What was Hundreds of Beavers?
Mm-hmm.
They did like a touring thing. That was a fun one, because that was like an old school silent film. And they had a whole touring aspect of the rollout and stuff.
Ryan Johnson, I know, recorded like a commentary for one of the Knives Out that you could listen to, like a podcast, like you just download and listen to one of the theaters to. So you,
that's
you
fun. Watch,
no, that's cool.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like listening to. So
I think
all these
more and more.
You know, let me set you up with a question. Like, what avenues can we take as filmmakers to build this sort of hype anticipation around our work that could bring the audience into your world, engage the audience in a different way, an alternative way that's like maybe outside of the norm. That I'm watching this, I'm seeing what they did here. I'm like, dude, why aren't we having, like, why can't a filmmaker book 2 weekends in Vegas at the Sphere and we have some type of other alternative viewing experience? Your guys' thoughts on these avenues for independent filmmaker or for maybe even bigger league filmmakers. Yeah. Like, what can we do aside from to build it? This rollout was fucking fire, dog.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna lie.
You know what's just off the top of my fucking head is this is some like super niche nerdy ass shit. But there's all these like giant D&D streamer shows, but I'm sure that they do this already, but like there should be more like indie films that have like one off RPG campaigns where you can have like whatever your movie is, like some backstory bullshit for the setting for your movie. Just like write a one off D&D campaign, pay some streamers to do a fucking like one off session.
I like
and
that.
Then, so, you know, make that available to the public or whatever. Like there's so many avenues. And I think the more that media monopolizes in the current regime, as like power consolidates, the more that's going to open up people who are rejecting the one source of media that they're going to get. So I think that this is an opportunity now more than ever to do that kind of weird shit, to like really experiment with how you're reaching people, because there's going to be people looking to alternative ways of getting information. Like now more than ever.
Absolutely.
As our media fails us.
Yeah.
Your thoughts, Max?
I think it's an interesting question. It's actually a question I've been struggling with just because of the industrialization, like film, music, video, film and video games, probably the most so, but music and even publishing, like other art forms that require a lot of industry, essentially capital and people to make and then distribute, and the mechanisms by which those things are brought to people. I think you're onto something. I've still just never really seen where it works outside of like niche sort of things.
Like my examples are all very niche.
Yeah. And I'm looking at like I know this, you know, it's a white boy here. So from the rock world, like Geese, where you're seeing a band do art rock that is taking off and really popular, which is
enlighten me. What's that mean?
It's like they're just a rock band. They're like a modern up and coming rock band that are doing like,
it's funny.
Not
I was texting
like,
you about them. Cause I was like, I would really love to hear your take on this album. just
cause
as a complete kind of outsider.
Yeah. Cause it's very not what rock and what people are doing right now. It's very avant. It's pulling more from like Velvet Underground shit from the 60s. Like they're getting kind of avant-garde with it. And the album that is like their most popular album, the one that they dropped last year, it was one of those things that like, why is this popular? Because it seems like it would actively be pushing people away. But they are doing impromptu concerts. They are a jam band. They go off script all the time at their live shows, and they do pop-up shows in New York. Mm. So it's one of those things that like, I think that you can't discount that constant fan engagement where you're talking about with music rollouts. Mm-hmm. I just haven't seen that work with film people. And I don't know if that's because film people are like basement dwelling gargoyles that don't have a groove, so they're not like music folk who like to go out and dance, or if
that's interesting, the crowd,
or if it's like,
that's an interesting point.
It's like, I mean, that was kind of what theaters are like. A lot of the problems that young people have with movies today, I'm talking to younger people, are like, I can't focus on a movie. Put them in a movie theater and like they'll watch Iron Lung, which I think is like the longest movie ever for a 2-hour solo movie. But like they buy into it, like even if they're not like Markiplier fans. And I'm like, yeah, it's because you're locked in a black space, like in a dark room with in crazy sound design. It's like that's really what theaters are. How you kind of democratize that space for people to like do a traveling roadshow that's not like you're kind of you're having to make deals with the theaters or independent theaters or usually music venues too, where they'll just bring a screen in. But like, I don't know. I don't have a good answer for that. I would like to crack it because none of if you're making alternative cinema right now, that you're fucking there's nothing outside of there's no venue for you right now. As particularly right now with what just happened, well, what has been happening with the consolidation of the media empire, like you just if you are not fitting in a very increasingly narrow circle of what's acceptable to make with a budget, you are on your own. So things like you're talking about, like John Waters style cinema, things like that type of stuff is only going to thrive in if we can crack that puzzle, which is how do you do what music is doing, or how do you do what publishing or independent publishing has largely done, and separate that from most social media or know how to use it very specifically. And we're already kind of seeing that with, like with the Marty Supreme thing, that whole big media rollout. Oh yeah. Like just using social media massively. So with Timothée Chalamet, I mean, Timothée Chalamet was the marketing campaign, just he was him
all over the place.
And then what Neon, which unfortunately Neon's marketing division just got bought up by Warner Brothers. But or just went to Warner Brothers. But the Neon, like movies that people largely kind of walk away from being lukewarm. It's those movies like Perkins' career is made off of Long Legs. That's just Neon's marketing department. They're just really good at knowing how to like tap into what audiences might be looking for. And even if they can't quite deliver it, they can get you there most of the way. And it's non-traditional, but I don't know how you make it. I just don't. I've tried. Yeah. I've thought about it.
Yeah.
Because now you're talking on top of production. You're now talking about taking a tour versus buying up theaters versus. So now you're also looking at an expensive distribution model as well. Still for indie.
Oh yeah. I don't think. I mean, go listen to our Beyond the Valley of the Dolls episode where we crack the case with the OnlyFans.
There is a joke. A lot of people I know who do practicals for movies, most of their money is practicals for cosplayers on OnlyFans. We're seeing the porn thing like actually spread into saying, like the arts.
What we're saying is that this needs to like the braid needs to come back together and sexploitation as a genre needs a resurgence.
I mean, so it is how you get some of the biggest names out of
titty films.
That's how you get some of the biggest names in 70s cinema. They all started in the valley. All got their starts in the valley. So
it's the resurgence. It's the 2026, 2027.
Yep, we're
putting our flag down.
Put our flag down on porn. It's you know, funny aside, that was the first job I tried to get.
Tasteful.
Yeah. The giant Vivid that used to be off the 101. I tried to get a job there, man. When I first moved to LA, I tried to get a job.
That was my friends in college before I left to go do film had a running bet of how many years I would be in LA before I did porn.
Yeah, that's always the joke, right? Is how many years before you
never did. Yeah,
I never had the pleasure. Never had the pleasure.
Never had the pleasure.
Sean Baker was taking up all the work.
Tangerine.
I did a bunch of pre-production, like put a budget together for a pitch for a like more explicit Westworld porn. They were gonna spend a shitload of money on a like hardcore Westworld porn. And we put together a budget for like the camera lighting package, and that never felt.
I've got it. It's gonna make billions of dollars. Fuck dolls. It's brilliant. No one's thought of it before, ever.
Ever.
Inception. Fuck dolls. Go.
Sorry. That's like a Stan Lee 2 impression. It sounded like Stan Lee.
It was half Stan Lee, half David Lynch.
I'll go to Lynch real quick. Lynch.
Great stuff there, guys. Just circle back on this. That was Baby Keem's Casino Project album that was released. Incredible stuff.
We got so
it's like the sad parent who's just like, back in the van, we gotta go home.
I love the compulsion in your brain that you need to close the tag, though.
Yep.
That you're like, no matter how long it's been and how far off topic we are, I am going to close the tag out.
Yep. Circling back.
So good. So good. Sean's like, I'm a prince so now. And I'm like, I'm the princess. And he's like, sure you are, buddy. Time to get home.
Let's get stop for some McDonald's on the way back.
Yeah, right. anyway.
Great album. Last thing I want to say is the album cover. You know, you like an artist if you like their album art. The one for this is a stark picture of Baby Keem's baby photo and using the parental advisory sticker in a really unique way, blowing it up to where the parental and the advisory is like kind of right up under his chin as a baby, knowing that those are themes kind of going with the album. Really love that. May steal it for our artwork coming up with the Sonya Green thing for this one. Maybe that's the tagline.
I'm very excited. That's cool.
I want to check out this documentary. Yeah. I didn't get a chance to watch it before the episode, but I'm definitely going to watch it.
I'm going to watch it. I just like anything that involves spaces or different ways of just like rolling things out. It's hell good.
Hell yeah. All right, guys. Max, we want to thank you so much again for joining us, talking your film Visions of Sonya Green. Like I said, it's available in the show notes. Please go support that. Go watch that.
Thanks for having me, y'all. Thanks for that.
Max, friend of the pod. We're looking forward to your episode coming up. I know we got some stuff planned a little later on in the year.
I know. I know. I had a sexy movie for you, E. I just don't know. I don't know if you're ready for it. I don't know if you're ready for Isabella Johnny. And
is that the one you
I was gonna yeah movie? Yeah someday I'll force you to watch Possession. Someday we'll get into some real dark shit.
Someday soon we go. Max is always anyway. Welcome. So great. We also want to mention two more house cleaning notes. One, we got show bills now, guys. I'm going to start illustrating what's sort of just an announcement, show bills about our content calendar. Be expecting those to pop up on our socials and maybe a part of our Patreon outreach with Uncle Ant's secret stash. Secret or private? Private stash. Private stash. You may be a little collectible cards in there, depending on your tier. And we also want, and so, you know, keep a lookout and engage with those because our content calendar coming up for next month is really, really exciting. We're doing Inside Baseball, Films on Films, the films that make Hollywood, workplace comedies that take place in Hollywood. So some really great selections. We got three of them coming up. We're going to announce those in the show bill. The first one is going to be McGee's pick coming up next week in 1999's Galaxy Quest. This is a sci-fi comedy about a washed-up cast of canceled 1970s sci-fi TV actors who are mistaken for real heroes by an alien race that beams them into space to fight a real enemy. So this is going to be a really fun film. So Sigourney Weaver, Tim Allen, a lot of faces.
This is a stacking cast. That movie's got a crazy cast.
Available on Prime Video, AMC Plus, and for free, I believe, on Pluto and Sling. Don't quote me on that. Nice. No, I can't remember exactly where I'm watching.
At the time of recording. You just always get the out if you just say at the time of recording. Because exactly. Then it's always like, hey, if it's not when you search, that's not my fault.
But a really fun film. Looking forward to that next week. Appreciate it, guys.
Always a blast.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplybox, theme song by Soul Spy. Coming soon, folks.